From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Dear Mr. Secretary, I am joining my colleague John Brady Keisling in submitting my resignation from the Foreign Service because I cannot in good conscience support President Bush's war plans against Iraq.
A second U.S. diplomat resigns over the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq. We'll talk to John Brown. The U.S. Agency for International Development is quietly asking U.S. corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel to apply for contracts to rebuild post-war Iraq. The contract could be worth $900 million. And what are you doing in this time of war? We'll hear from Democracy Now! Listeners. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Washington was forced to admit last night for the first time it might have to invade Iraq without British support because of massive opposition to war in Britain. U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday it is, quote, unclear that what role Britain will take. The Pentagon later retracted Rumsfeld's comments, but not before it caused a panic with Tony Blair's government. The Guardian of London reports the absence of Britain from the invasion force would represent a serious political blow for George Bush, who has sought to convince the American public he is not acting unilaterally. Blair desperately needs the second resolution to prevent revolt by his ministers and MPs. Yesterday, 40 Labour MPs called on Tony Blair to resign, and one member of his cabinet, Claire Short, Secretary for International Development, has threatened to resign herself if Britain goes to war without UN support. And Blair has been told by government lawyers that it will be illegal for Britain to participate in a war without a second resolution. Opponents to war within Blair's government seized on Rumsfeld's comments. One Labour MP, Graham Allen, said, "The cat is out of the bag. They can do it without us and give Tony Blair the chance to get out of the hole if he wishes." As hundreds of thousands of Iraqis' lives are in the balance, the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday banned the word French from its cafeteria menus. Republican Bob Ney of Ohio unilaterally ordered the ban. He's chair of the House Administration Committee, and no vote was required. As debate on the issue raged, the Capitol Hill menu has already changed. A sign in the food court announced, "Update, now serving in all House office buildings, Freedom Fries." French toast is also banned. The United States and Britain indicated yesterday they would consider granting Iraq a short extension beyond March 17th to fully disarm before facing war. But the White House dismissed a proposal backed by six council members to give Baghdad a 45-day deadline. The administration vowed it would push for a vote this week on a UN resolution to go to war. Foreign journalists are accusing Pakistan's intelligence service of faking the arrest of alleged Al-Qaeda lieutenant Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Pakistani agents announced they arrested Mohammed several days ago in the city of Rawalpindi. The White House claims Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the mastermind behind the September 11th attacks. On Monday, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence held an unprecedented news conference to try to quell the questions. Officials played a grainy video they claim showed the arrest. But according to Reuters, few journalists were convinced. The video never showed Mohammed's face nor any sign of a struggle. Many said it looked like a crude reconstruction. The Guardian of London is reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney is still being paid up to $1 million a year in deferred compensation from his former company, Halliburton. The Texas-based firm was recently awarded the Pentagon's contract to put out potential oil field fires in Iraq and is one of five U.S. firms that has been invited to bid for a $900 million contract to rebuild Iraq after a war. Without permission to launch U.S. ground troops from Turkey for a northern front in Iraq, the Pentagon is now asking to fly warplanes over Turkish airspace. The Los Angeles Times reports the Turkish army has already sent 300 truckloads of tanks, ambulances, and equipment toward the Iraqi border, apparently in preparation for entering Iraq on its own. One Western diplomat in Turkey said they're gathering at the starting line and waiting for the gun to sound. A federal appeals court ruled yesterday that the 650 detainees held at a U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have no legal rights in the United States and may not ask courts to review their detentions. This ruling will allow detainees to be held indefinitely without access to lawyers or judges. Amnesty International responded by saying, quote, "To hold people without charge and without access to legal counsel risks the creation of an American gulag for those detained in the course of the war on terror." Meanwhile, a federal district judge has ruled that U.S. citizen Jose Padilla must be allowed to meet with his attorney. The Bush administration has categorized Padilla as an enemy combatant with no legal rights. He's accused of plotting to detonate a dirty bomb in the United States. The Air Force yesterday tested the largest conventional bomb in the American arsenal. The 20,000-pound bomb is designed to explode a few feet above the ground and to send a devastating wave of fire and blast hundreds of yards to kill troops, flatten trees, knock over structures, collapse cave entrances. The weapon is officially called the Massive Ordnance Air Blast. Less formally, it is known as the mother of all bombs. The New York Times reports the bomb could be dropped on Iraq.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground. And I won't.
Johnny Cash, I Won't Back Down, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners around the country in this expanded edition of Democracy Now! And a special welcome to the listeners at WPFW in Washington who are running the program starting today and will continue to do so.
That's right. In the expanded 2 hours, also to welcome to WMPG listeners in Maine, as well as the many listeners around the country, KPFK in Los Angeles, and others that are doing the full 2 hours. A very hearty hello. Well, a veteran U.S. diplomat resigned Monday in protest over the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq. In a letter of resignation to Secretary of State General Colin Powell, John Brown wrote, "Throughout the globe, the United States is becoming associated with the unjustified use of force. The president's disregard for views in other nations, borne out by his neglect of public diplomacy, is giving birth to an anti-American sentry."
John Brown joined the State Department in 1981. He has served at U.S. embassies in London, Prague, Krakow, Kiev, Belgrade, and Moscow. Meanwhile, a senior Australian intelligence officer has quit in protest at what he said was Australia's dangerous rush to war. Office of National Assessments analyst Andrew Wilkie said Iraq does not pose any security threat to Australia, the United States, or Britain. He said Iraq's weapons program was actually degraded and its military weak. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. diplomat John Brady Keisling resigned from the U.S. Embassy in Athens. John Brown joins us now from Washington, D.C., where he's currently affiliated with the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University.
We welcome you to Democracy Now!, John Brown.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to reach your listeners.
Well, why don't you start off by just taking us through the journey that you took to come to the point where you resigned?
Well, it was a long journey, of course. It was not an easy decision, but as I look back, there were really two main reasons why I submitted my resignation. The first one is simply that I believe that the president has failed to present a convincing case to us and to the world that massive force should be used against Iraq at this time. And secondly, I felt that I had to speak out about this failure of the president. I felt I had to share my views with my fellow Americans. As a Foreign Service officer, I admire the fact that in our country we can speak out, and so I felt I had to speak out.
In terms of, often it's been portrayed that that Secretary of State Powell has attempted to be the voice of reason within the administration, and apparently, or at least of moderation within the administration, and some respect for international law and international accords and agreement. What's your perspective? You're able to share with us in terms of within the State Department how the debate has gone on.
Well, let me answer that by saying that diplomats, by their very nature, always try to seek peaceful solutions through negotiations. This is what they want to do, and to avoid the use of force as much as possible. So I think that this view is shared by many diplomats, not only in the United States, but abroad as well.
Could you read for us the letter that you wrote to General Colin Powell, Secretary of State?
Well, let me just underscore a section of it in which I say the following. I say I'm submitting my resignation, and I say why the president has failed in his policy at this point, and his war plans against Iraq are, I think, not presented convincingly, and I say the following. The president has failed to explain clearly why our brave men and women in uniform should be ready to sacrifice their lives in a war on Iraq at this time. The president has failed to lay out the full ramifications of this war, including the extent of innocent civilian casualties. The president has failed to specify the economic costs of the war for ordinary Americans. The president has failed to clarify how the war would help rid the world of terror. And the president has failed to take international public opinion against the war into serious consideration.
What kind of response have you gotten from your colleagues
outside? I'm a great internet fan, and I've been online for the past couple of days, you can understand, and I've gotten many, many messages of support, and only 4 messages criticizing my position. So it's been very encouraging, I must say. From all over the world, I've received messages of support, including a journalist whom I knew quite well when I was in Serbia during the Dayton peace process, an admirable man who fought the Milosevic regime, and I was very, very touched to receive an email from him expressing his support for the position that I took.
As a veteran diplomat, you've obviously over the years made friendships and contacts with many other diplomats in a variety of capitals. How do you, at this stage, as you characterize it that we're in the danger of becoming an anti-American century, how do you sense the mood among peoples in other countries and the diplomatic community as the U.S. Appears to be determined, this administration seems to be determined to go to war regardless of what the eventual vote is in the United Nations?
Well, my sense, and, you know, I came back from Russia in August 2001, and I've been since then reading foreign public opinion, reports on public opinion abroad closely, in part because of the courses I was giving at Georgetown. My sense is that the world thinks America is not listening to them, that we decide without consulting, that we talk down to the rest of the world. And people abroad believe that this is not in the American tradition, because what we are admired for and is really not our force, but our generosity. And I think many people are disappointed that our policy right now is not reflecting this great American tradition of generosity.
We're talking to John Brown, a U.S. diplomat who has submitted his letter of resignation to Secretary of State General Colin Powell over the push for an invasion in Iraq. You also are a professor. You teach in Washington at Georgetown University. Have you gotten responses from the university? What is their reaction to your resignation?
Well, I've gotten some emails from students expressing support for my position. I received an email from a faculty member there as well. My status at Georgetown right now is not 100% clear because I was at Georgetown under the State Department program, and I have to talk to the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy, who's out of town right now, about where I will continue, if I do continue at Georgetown at this point. But as I said, I have received encouraging messages from students there. I taught a course on American public diplomacy last semester, and so I'm glad that I can continue sharing ideas with students.
And your reaction to the growing movement in this country as well as around the world calling for keeping the peace and for not going to war, how do you, when you see all of these people, ordinary Americans out in the streets in all kinds of places, not just in big cities but in small towns, what's your reaction?
Well, let me just say this. I observe the demonstrations here in Washington, and my overwhelming impression of the participants in these demonstrations is that they were ordinary citizens concerned about our policy. Very serious serious but not solemn demonstrations expressing concern. People who had really thought about this issue and said, you know, we're not convinced here. What are we getting ourselves into? What are the consequences? And so I do think that there is here in the U.S. a sense that we are not being, that policy is not being explained satisfactorily.
John Brown, I was looking, in addition to your letter, looking at your letter of resignation, is looking at the resignation letter of U.S. diplomat John Brady Keesling. Is he someone that you know?
He's someone I greatly admire. I have not had the pleasure of meeting him. I can't deny that his letter had had a great impact on me and certainly led one of the things that did lead to my decision to submit my resignation.
Well, I wanted to read a section from that letter. It is written February 27, 2003, from Athens, Greece, to Secretary Colin Powell. And it says, "Dear Mr. Secretary, I am writing you to submit my resignation from the Foreign Service of the United States and from my position as political counselor in U.S. Embassy Athens, effective March 7th. I do so with a heavy heart. The baggage of my upbringing included a felt obligation to give something back to my country. Service as a U.S. diplomat was a dream job." And he goes on for a paragraph and then says, "Until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer. The policies we are now asked to advance are incompatible not only with American values, but also with American interests. Our fervent pursuit of war with Iraq is driving us to squander the international legitimacy that has been America's most potent weapon of both defense and offense since the days of Woodrow Wilson. We have begun to dismantle the largest and most effective web of international relationships the world has ever known. Our current course will bring instability and danger, not security." John Brady Keesling goes on to say in his resignation letter, "The sacrifice of global interest to domestic politics and to bureaucratic self-interest is nothing new, and it is certainly not a uniquely American problem. Still, we have not seen such systematic distortion of intelligence, such systematic manipulation of American opinion since the war in Vietnam. He says in his next paragraph, "We should ask ourselves why we have failed to persuade more of the world that a war with Iraq is necessary. We have over the past 2 years done too much to assert to our world partners that narrow and mercenary U.S. interests override the cherished values of our partners. Even where our aims were not in question, our consistency is at issue. The model of Afghanistan is little comfort to allies wondering on what basis we plan to rebuild the Middle East and in whose image and interests. Have we indeed become blind, as Russia is blind in Chechnya, as Israel is blind in the occupied territories, to our own advice that overwhelming military power is not the answer to terrorism? After the shambles of post-war Iraq joins the shambles of Grozny and Ramallah, it will be a brave foreigner who forms ranks with Micronesia to follow where we lead." Just a few of the paragraphs from an extended letter of U.S. diplomat John Brady Keesling, who resigned in the last few weeks with that letter to Secretary Colin Powell. Juan?
And clearly the feeling is spreading among among career foreign service people, as well as career political leaders in other countries. Tony Blair, Prime Minister Blair, has a major problem in Great Britain right now. And the New York Times is reporting today in its front pages that his government could very well fall, depending on whether or not Britain agrees to go along with the United States in essentially a solo effort or a coalition of the willing, as opposed to an international coalition on the situation in Iraq. Your sense of the situation in Britain, Mr. Brown?
Well, I began my foreign service career in London, but my experience is more in Eastern Europe and Russia. I do know from emails that I've gotten from Russian friends that they're concerned about this war, and that they don't understand what our government is doing. And again, you know, I had the privilege in my work in Eastern Europe and Russia, because I was in press and cultural affairs, to meet, if you will, and it was a great privilege, the best and the brightest in the intellectual community, the so-called Russian intelligentsia, which has contributed so much to culture of Russia and in fact, world culture. And I sense there great concern about our policy, again, especially this use of force people in that part of the world don't associate with the best of the United States. As I say, we're respected for our values, not our power. And I'm afraid that, as I said, this policy is going to make America less and less understood throughout the world.
John Brown, two last questions. One, are you getting any sense that there are other resignations imminent?
I don't know. I've had discussions with colleagues. I can't say I speak for all of them. I think it's safe to say that there is a great concern amongst some of my colleagues, but what steps they will take, I can't say.
And last question, for those who question your patriotism.
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about the United States, and you know, is that one can speak out. And I haven't heard anybody yet raise doubts about my patriotism. And again, as I say, I'm just happy and proud that I can speak out here in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, John Brown, veteran U.S. diplomat who served in many U.S. embassies around the world, currently affiliated with the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University, has handed his resignation letter to Secretary of State General Colin Powell. And we'll have that resignation letter, as well as U.S. diplomat John Brady Keesling, on our website, a link to it at www.democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. We'll be right back. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Bush administration is preparing to award a contract valued at upwards of $900 million to U.S. firms in the rebuilding of post-war Iraq. The U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID, quietly sent a detailed request for proposals to Halliburton, Bechtel, Fluor, Lewis Berger Group, and Parsons Corporation. USAID invoked special authority to bypass the usual procedures and solicit bids from just these selected companies. AID spokesperson Ellen Yount told the Washington Post skirting the rules is justified due to the, quote, urgent circumstances and the unique nature of this work.
The Toronto Star is reporting international firms from countries that are not publicly backing Washington's policy on Iraq are also expected to be prevented from profiting on the reconstruction of that country. The Pentagon already has tapped Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root to help fight oil well fires in Iraq. Halliburton is the company Vice President Dick Cheney headed until the year 2000. The London Guardian reports today that Vice President Cheney is still receiving annual payments from Halliburton. Halliburton refused to say how much the payments are. The required disclosure statement filed by all top government officials says only that they are between $100,000 and $1 million.
We're joined today by two reporters. Prothap Chatterjee is an independent journalist who has done extensive research on Halliburton, and Neil King is a staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal. His article, U.S. is Quietly Soliciting Bids for Rebuilding Post-War Iraq, appeared in Monday's Journal. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Neil King, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the preparations and the request for proposals that has gone out?
Well, the USAID sent these out about 3 weeks ago in the middle of last month. They've justified the whole sort of secrecy and speed of the thing as these are unusual circumstances. They need to move quickly, and they have the desire, unlike what happened in Afghanistan, to essentially coordinate instantaneous reconstruction work with the humanitarian effort sort of immediately after the end of any war. So there's this emphasis on speed, and there was, of course, also a degree or a high degree of secrecy, if only because of the weird awkwardness of all of these times and that, you know, they keep continually repeat that the president hasn't decided to go to war while all sorts of parts of the bureaucracy are planning for the aftermath. So there's kind of a built-in strain there that I think many parts of the government have been at some pains to disguise.
Now, your article seems to mention a variety of different things that the government is looking for. One is obviously the contract that's already been let for possible rebuilding of the oil fields in case of fires at the oil fields. The other is reconstruction of the country. But then there's also an administration contract to administer a variety. It says in your article here, Iraq's main seaports, international airports, hospitals and health clinics, and primary and secondary schools, and another for trucking in and warehousing water, electrical generators, and other crucial supplies.
There are actually there are six contracts within the USAID network that are out there. Basically, as you elicited, all of those various ones are separate individual tasks. Some of them, I understand, have already been signed. There's one of the oddities, and it's also causing a bit of an uproar in the NGO community, is that there seems to be a kind of concerted effort or decision already made to skirt, in some cases, the offering some of these services to NGOs, especially, for instance, you mentioned the trucking of water and that sort of thing, which is a number of NGOs are very well suited to doing that kind of thing. My understanding is that that contract in particular has already gone out to a for-profit company that does similar sort of work. At the same time, there's also, I had a story today that mentioned that the Army Corps of Engineers has up to five contracts that are also out on the street to do a whole variety of barracks, building, and other kinds of things. That is going to be worth up to $500 million. And it's also gone out under a similar sort of expedited procedure to in this case, 12 pre-selected companies with some overlap. Bechtel is, for instance, one of those companies. There's a certain number of companies that do a lot of this kind of work, and so they're traditionally on the list for these kinds of contracts, and Halliburton is one of those companies which also happens to have good political connections, but is has done this kind of thing for decades.
What about the fact that Vice President Dick Cheney is still receiving annual payments from Halliburton, the company that he headed until 2000? The London Guardian is reporting that today.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of thing that creates an automatic conflict. It may, in the end, for all we know, be more of a burden to Halliburton than anything else, if only because they end up being the company that is automatically under the most scrutiny, and especially under a circumstance like this, where my article, I got so many emails from around the world filled with outrage that, you know, people sort of insinuating that this war in the end is all about money and profit, and that, you know, Halliburton is going to make money, and all these kinds of theories like that. I mean, it may in the end prove that if there's a tendency to go one way or the other, it would perhaps to be to go away from Halliburton, if only because of the controversy. But, a number of these companies are pretty well hooked into the political apparatus because they live in large part by government contracts. So they're pretty wily, no matter whether they have a vice president who happens to have previously been their CEO.
But the extensive nature of the contracts that are being let seems, to indicate that the nature of the U.S. administration of Iraq is going to be very, it's not just at the top levels of the government, but in essence, the government is preparing to contract all of the vital government services to American companies. I would assume it's not just for a few months, but it would have to be for an extended period of time.
Well, if you look back, actually, to what was going on in Iraq before the Gulf War with some of these big dam projects and that sort of thing, or if you look at the work that happened in Kuwait after Desert Storm, you'll see more of the model that's likely to take place, which is, for instance, this $900 million contract is an oversight prime contracting job where much of the work that $900 million would go to pay for could well go to all kinds of other companies. For instance, Bechtel was running a big dam operation in Iraq when the Gulf War broke out. It was basically the overseer while the actual work was being done by, I think it was a Turkish and a Bosnian company, if I remember it right. And it's very likely that that will be more close to the scenario where a lot of the big heavy lifting stuff will be done by local companies or companies in the region, whether if only in part because it makes sense, but secondly because I think there is going to be a political effort to at least sort of help one's allies, and perhaps, I don't know, I'm not necessarily sure that there will be a lot of punishing one's enemies necessarily, but there could be a bit of that too. It all depends on how multilateral this effort becomes, and at the moment it's completely unilateral because the U.S. is the only country that's sort of preparing and prepared to pay for this sort of thing. So I suppose there, if that's the case, it will remain fairly national, if you know what I mean.
We're also joined on the telephone, in addition to Neil King, staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal, by Prothap Chatterjee. Prothap has just recently returned from Turkey, where you spent time on Halliburton-run bases. Can you comment on this Wall Street Journal report on the Bush administration's request for proposals from five specific U.S. companies?
It's not entirely surprising. Halliburton has won a number of contracts from the U.S. Army as a result of this quote-unquote war on terrorism. And, the list is quite astonishing, ranging from the contracts after the war in Afghanistan to run the Bagram and Kandahar U.S. military bases. Brown & Root is the company running those bases. Karshi, Uzbekistan, and Central Uzbekistan, the base from which the Afghanistan war was run has been run for almost a year now by Brown & Root, and they've gotten the contract to build the prison facilities for the Taliban in Guantanamo Bay from the U.S. Navy. So this sort of thing is sort of par for the course. They are getting a lot of contracts right now. They're running, as you mentioned, the base in Turkey, in Incirlik, from which the U.S. no-fly zones are maintained. They've done that for the last 12 years. They just got a contract in Kuwait, where they are also running U.S. military operations on a private contract basis for this particular war. So I'm not surprised they've been shortlisted to get the contracts for rebuilding Iraq. it's the way the U.S. military certainly works, which is they send out bids to companies that they're already comfortable with. And so currently Halliburton has a contract which is under something called LOGCAP, which is the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program. And basically it's a 10-year open-ended contract by which they don't have to report to the public how much money they're paying to Halliburton for running operations during wartime. And this is not the kind of thing that Neil's article was about, but literally running the military bases. And, you know, back here at home, they're running, you know, El Centro Naval Base in California. They're running Fort Knox in Kentucky. And they've gotten contracts, you know, to shut down the Fort Ord in Monterey, for which they overbilled the government, and then just about a year ago paid $2 million to settle the overbilling charges with the federal government.
Perthap, since you have been following Halliburton for extensively now for quite a period of time, have you been able to judge whether the size of their contracts from the government have increased substantially since the Bush administration took power, or is it basically that they've always been historically a major contractor for the Pentagon?
Well, they have Brown & Root and Halliburton. Now, Halliburton owns Brown & Root, but they didn't always do that. Has always been a fairly major contractor to the U.S. government. But the amount of contracts they've been getting has actually increased substantially, actually, since the Clinton administration. And Brown & Root itself is no stranger to war. They, together with Bechtel, were both extensively involved in Vietnam, where they were building military bases. Bechtel, for example, built the Da Nang base, and Brown & Root was very involved in the demilitarized zone, multi-million-dollar contracts. What has happened actually in recent years, actually since, particularly since Dick Cheney left his previous job with Bush Sr., is that they've been able to substantially increase contracts with the U.S. government. And just to put that in context, when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, he actually oversaw a contract to look into the possibility of privatization a part of the U.S. military, what I like to call the MASH functions, the functions of, you know, sweeping up the offices, serving the food, building the barracks, and that kind of thing. So they got a contract to study this possible privatization, and then once it was like a $4 million contract. And they got another contract to update that, and then they got the first LOGCAP contract, the contract I referred to earlier, to privatize these functions. And then right after they got that, Dick Cheney, having left government and spent a year or two at a think tank in Washington, D.C., then came to head the company up. And he brought with him Dave Gribben, who was sort of a aide to him in the Secretary of Defense. And between them, they substantially increased something like tenfold the amount of government contracts they get, including a $2.2 billion contract to run operations for the U.S. Army in former Yugoslavia. So they've gotten a lot of contracts under the Clinton administration as a result of Dick Cheney's helmmanship at the company.
I just wanted to ask one last question to Neil King, the author of the Wall Street Journal piece on the U.S. companies getting the contracts to rebuild post-war Iraq. It may sound like a silly question, but how does it work? I mean, in order to bid on a contract, you have to know what's at stake. Now, does the U.S. government say, we're going to destroy this many schools, this many water treatment facilities, what will you charge? You know, to rebuild them, so that the U.S. government lays out the war plans to these private corporations?
Well, it's strange. I mean, I did get a hold of a document that was kind of one of the supporting things in terms of the idea of what the scope of the work might be from USAID. And this is not with the specificity that what might go to the government, I mean, sorry, to the companies, but it did, you know, the USAID is in the business of sort of planning for the worst and hoping for the best, as they like to say, but it was still a bit disturbing to see the kinds of things that they thought might occur. I mean, they were saying, for instance, that at the moment, I think if I remember this right, 75% of Iraq is fully electrized, or anyway, electricity is available to 75% of the country. and that they were saying that post-war they were hoping within 6 months to have returned the electricity grid to 15% of the country, if I remember it right. There was a lot of kind of worst-case scenarios like that. You know, a lot, like for instance with the Army Corps of Engineer contracts that are out there now, they have, what they're doing is indefinite quantity, sort of indefinite duration contracts where they ask companies to say, what would it cost for you to pave or build a road of this length and to build a barracks of this description with water and sewage, et cetera? And then in the end, what the work might be is building, you know, 50 of those barracks or whatever. I mean, what's going on with the USAID things is similar. It would be, except for in this case, it's oversight. I'm not really sure exactly how they, because it's not, I think the point you raise is an interesting one, because it's not exactly typical bidding where in the end somebody would come in, you know, $20 million cheaper than the other person, because in the end, this is not how cheaply one can do it, but how you can prove that you're the right person to oversee an indeterminate project.
Neil King, if I can interrupt you just to ask one last question because we're running out of time, is the Bush administration has resisted being able to put a price tag on the reconstruction of Iraq or the cost of the war. Isn't part of that, as some reports have indicated, the reason for that is that they're actually hoping to be able to finance a lot of the work by taking some of the revenues from the oil revenues of Iraq once the military occupies the country?
It is. You know, there was a briefing yesterday by some defense officials at the Pentagon that got at this a bit, and they were mentioning the possibility of using frozen Iraqi assets. Now, they were bringing this up to, because they're now talking about paying the salaries of Iraqi bureaucrats and putting the soldiers to work and all this sort of stuff, and also the possibility of using Iraqi oil revenues for reconstruction. You know, just as a quick aside, this $900 million figure is really minuscule by comparison to what's actually likely to be spent. I think what went into Kuwait afterwards, of course, this also includes rebuilding the oil fields and so on, was many, many billions of dollars. And that was, of course, there was a lot of devastation there, but what might occur across a much larger country in Iraq could be many, many times what happened in Kuwait.
And finally, Bechtel is one of the companies that was named in the documents from Iraq to the United Nations in December of companies that helped to build up the Iraqi military arsenal. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Neil King is Wall Street Journal reporter. His piece appeared in Monday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Prepares for Rebuilding of Iraq. Initial plan could spend as much as $900 million on repair after war for a few U.S. corporations. And Prothap Chatterjee, reporter in the Bay Area, California, just returned from Turkey, where he spent time on Halliburton-run bases. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a young man does well on his SATs. The reward? The Army starts making a lot of calls to him. We'll find out why. Stay with us.
Back when Eisenhower was the president, golf courses is where most of his time was spent. So I never really listened to what the president said, because in general, I believed that the general was politically dead. But he always seemed to know when the muscles were about to be flexed, because I remember him saying something, mumbling something about a military-industrial complex. Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe, just to keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex. All they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary.
Gil Scott Heron here on Democracy Now! War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
There's a little-known provision in the federal No Child Left Behind Act which requires public high schools to release student contact information to military recruiters. But is there a link between signing up for the SAT and the military? Because because the way the information is distributed. Worried about the prospect of war with Iraq, Youth Radio's A.J. Herman decided to investigate and sent us this story.
A few months ago, I got a letter from the United States Army. It said my outstanding performance in school and on the SATs was enough to put me in the running for a spot in West Point's class of 2007. Within the next few weeks, I got emails or letters from every branch of the military, which amused my mom.
You're not the type who wants to lead a lifestyle where you have to constantly follow orders and be like everyone else. Or to put it in somewhat military terms, you like to march to the beat of the different drummer.
I also tend to be pretty curious. For example, I'm wondering how the military knows I scored so well on the SAT. Especially since I go to a private school, so we're not on the recruiter standard lists. I asked my principal, Carl Tierman, if he had any ideas.
The school would never send your SAT scores to any organization without your permission. The Educational Testing Services, which administers the SAT, may have a different policy.
Everyone signs up for the SAT through the College Board, so that was my next call.
Thank you for calling the College Board. This is Sarah. How can I help you?
I'm a high school senior. I took the SAT last May. I'm getting all the stuff in the mail from scholarships and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering who exactly gets that information. Do you send it to the military or the military academies or not?
I think the military academies are allowed to request that, yes.
So those military academies can request me when I don't request them. That's something few high school students know. If you've registered for the SAT, you probably checked the box on question number 8 that says, "Yes, I would like to participate in the student search service and have the College Board send information about me to colleges, universities, and governmental scholarship programs interested in students like me." And who wouldn't check that box? Every kid who checks it pictures being recruited by Harvard, Yale, and all kinds of schools with big fat scholarships, not the military and the ROTC, which offer scholarships in exchange for a commitment to service. A year ago, I wouldn't have cared. But with all this talk of war in Iraq, it freaks me out to realize that by checking a box on the SAT form, I've put myself on a list with the U.S. military. I decided to make another call to the College Board and double-check exactly who gets my information.
Let me check. Hold on, all right?
Okay. She never came back on the line, which made me nervous. I mean, these people know my Social Security number, along with lots of other personal information. So Youth Radio went right to the top, to the College Board headquarters in Manhattan. We called Executive Director Brian O'Reilly to find out how my name could go from the SAT registration form to the U.S. Air Force ROTC.
I'm pretty sure in stating that the name then did not come from us. I can't absolutely guarantee that because it could have been ordered through a university. But I believe that would not have come from us.
So he's saying when I send my information to a university, they can give it away. And if the ROTC gets the information, does that mean they can pass my name and ID to other parts of the military? When we talked to ROTC spokesperson Paul Katatis, he said to think of them like a car company. If you buy an Oldsmobile, chances are some Cadillac salespeople will get your name too. But then he refused a taped interview. So is anyone regulating student privacy in the SAT? We called a watchdog group called FairTest and talked to a guy named Bob Schaefer.
A key issue here is informed consent and whether students really understand every place their scores are being sent. When they register for the SAT and check the student search service, and that becomes an invasion of their privacy, and it does not meet the legal definition of informed consent.
It turns out the College Board sells student lists for 25 cents a name if the buyer meets their scholarship guidelines. Buyers can request names of students based on ethnicity, gender, range of SAT score, that kind of thing. The College Board says it tracks the names it releases, but come on, it can't guarantee privacy once the names are out there at universities all over the country. And they are out there. And from a teenager's perspective, it feels to me like the military has learned some tactics from telemarketers. I'm just glad my cell phone company hasn't given my name to the military. At least not yet. I'm A.J. Herman.
A.J. Herman is with Youth Radio. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to our listeners who've been calling in all over the country.
Hi, you've reached Democracy Now! Please leave your name, where you're calling from, the station you listen to, and what you're doing in this time of impending war. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Sanda in New York City. I was able to have a peace march of one plus a person pushing my wheelchair on Broadway for a mile. I was wearing a sign that said, no to war, not for Iraq oil, nor for empire, no to war on women and children in Iraq. And I've been putting up signs in my building. I have been making and distributing art for peace.
My name is Daryl Davis. I'm from Arcata, California. I listen to K-Mud. Hallelujah. One of the things I'm doing is specifically not repaying my student loan to the government as if I would give them a dime of my money at this point. Try to get that out there so that other people stop paying the government those kind of funds, because it's not going back to us. It's going somewhere else. Thanks.
I'm calling from Boulder, Colorado, where the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center started a campaign called Rice for Peace. The idea is to barrage the White House with tens of thousands of packets of rice. The message is that we should be sending food to Iraq, not bombs. So far, more than 10,000 packets of rice have been sent from 500 U.S. cities and 12 countries. To find out more, visit our website at www.riceforpeace.org. That's www.riceforpeace.org.
Name is Greg Giorgio, calling from Altamont, New York. I listen to WRPI. We're calling for a general strike in our upstate New York IWW branch at P.O. Box 74, Altamont, New York, 518-861-5627. Contact us with your thoughts and organization of your own work stoppages against this brutal destruction that our government is trying to level on Iraq and the world. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Will Rose. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. And in Seattle, there's an organization called the SNOW Coalition. It stands for Sound Nonviolent Opponents of War. That's Puget Sound. And they have organized probably three or four dozen different neighborhood groups all over the metropolitan area. Some of the things that we've been doing are, for example, we have a caravan of bikes and cars that are going to be circulating through different grids of downtown Seattle at different times of day with car top signs, banners, people on the sidewalk, honking, waving, and leafleting. SNOW Coalition is a really great model. Look at www.snowcoalition.org to get an idea of how well this particular organizing model can work in any city in America. Thanks.
My name is Zore. I am an Iranian-American. I'm calling from Emeryville, California. Fortunately, I have been able to introduce KPFA and Democracy Now! To Farsi language radio listeners, and I have talked about all the organizations against war and passed their telephone number and websites. I share the information I get from Democracy Now! And other sources in KPFA with them and with my fellow co-workers also. I email back the people who write pro-war essays and share my information and knowledge. I wrote a letter to President-elect Bush to stop this nonsense war and so many other things. I'm just one ordinary person, and I hope all the other ordinary people do as much as they can.
I have been involved in not paying federal income taxes for over 5 years now. I've not paid them a dime because I believe that the amount of war spending that is used in the federal government is outrageous. I would like to quote Henry David Thoreau on the duty of civil disobedience. If 1,000 men and women were not to pay their tax bills this year, that would not be a violent and bloody measure as it would be to pay them and enable the state to commit violence and shed innocent blood. If you'd like more information on not paying federal income tax for war, please give us a call at the Northern California War Tax Resistance, 510-843-9877. Thanks.
My name is Jennifer Deal. I listen to 89.3 WPFW in Washington, D.C., the capital of the police state. But we here in Washington and around the country are doing a national peace lobby to pass House Joint Resolution 20 to repeal the authority to use military force against Iraq. people need to call their Congress people or go to www.dawndc.net. Thank you again, and peace.
Hi, my name is Alice Thompson, and I'm calling from Columbia, Missouri. We watch on Free Speech TV. The day after war, if such an event would happen to start, we are urging everyone to take the day off of work or school, if possible, to call in sick of war and avoid shopping. Business owners are encouraged to shut down operations for that day, and we want to halt all normal activities and refocus attention on peace. Also, we urge people to wear black armbands to symbolize opposition to war and participate in morning and or evening rush hour demonstrations. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Charles Colt. I am calling from San Francisco, California. During this time of impending colonization, which is being labeled time of impending war, I've done three or four things besides joining protests, something I've never done before, never thought I would. I've been reading and reviewing a lot of books, trying to get as many people to stop looking at the corporate-controlled, completely pro-government biased media and start doing research of their own. I'll pretty much talk to anyone who's willing to listen. So I guess the biggest thing I'm doing is simply no longer being complacent and no longer allowing anyone who is close to me to be complacent either, not through force or through argument, but simply by not being the person I was anymore.
This is Tanya Z calling from New Mexico, where I listen on KUNM. I've been supporting MADRE, the Women's International Human Rights Organization, in their Every Child Has a Name campaign, which is raising money to send children's medicines and powdered milk to Iraq through UNICEF. Get your pens ready. They can be contacted in New York City at 212-627-0444 or email madre@madre.org, on the web at www.madreincaps.org. It's so vital that we put our money where our mouth is and make our movement humanitarian as well as political.
Just some of the comments of listeners around the country. And if you'd like to call in yours, call 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. And that does it for today's program. You can go to our website for more information. That is www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. And if you'd like to get us on your station, just give the station a call or go to our website for stations to find out how you can run us as well. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Dancing with the missing, dancing with the dead, dance with the invisible.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The bulldozer started pushing the house down while he was still inside. Stop, stop, we screamed, but the driver wouldn't listen. We finally had to run out, leaving Jamal under the rubble. I was screaming, my son is inside. The Israeli soldiers shouted back at us women, and they called us whores.
Searching Jenin, eyewitness accounts of the Israeli invasion. But first, did Pakistani intelligence officials fake the arrest of alleged al-Qaeda mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Foreign journalists in Pakistan begin to question Pakistani intelligence officials. We'll have a report from Islamabad. And Angola, Guinea, and Cameroon, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Danny Glover, and U.S.-based Africa advocacy groups are calling on these Security Council members to stand firm against U.S. pressure. We'll speak with Sally Booker and Jokey Jehu. All that and more coming up. We'll be right back. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Washington was forced to admit last night for the first time that it might have to invade Iraq without British support because of massive opposition to war in Britain. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday it is, quote, unclear what role Britain will take. The Pentagon later retracted Rumsfeld's comments, but not before it caused a panic within Tony Blair's government. The Guardian of London reports the absence of Britain from the invasion force would represent a serious political blow for George Bush, who has sought to convince the American public he is not acting unilaterally. Blair desperately needs the second resolution to prevent revolt by his ministers and MPs. Yesterday, 40 Labour MPs called on Blair to resign. And one member of his cabinet, Claire Short, has threatened to resign herself if Britain goes to war without UN support. And Blair has been told by government lawyers it will be illegal for Britain to participate in a war without a second resolution. A panel of national security experts predict the cost of post-war reconstruction of Iraq will cost at least $20 billion a year and will require the long-term deployment of up to 200,000 troops. The panel, organized by the Council on Foreign Relations, concludes that President Bush has failed, quote, to fully describe to Congress and the American people the magnitude of the resources that will be required to meet the post-conflict needs of Iraq. Senators criticized the Bush administration for being secretive about plans for a post-war Iraq. A Pentagon official failed to show up at a Senate hearing on Tuesday on the topic. The United States and Britain indicated yesterday they would consider granting Iraq a short extension beyond March 17th to fully disarm before facing war. But the White House dismissed a proposal backed by six council members to give Baghdad a 45-day deadline. The Guardian of London is reporting Vice President Dick Cheney is still being paid up to $1 million a year in deferred compensation from his former company, Halliburton. The Texas-based firm was recently awarded the Pentagon's contract to put out potential oil field fires in Iraq and is one of five U.S. firms that has been invited to bid for a $900 million contract to rebuild Iraq after a war. Without permission to launch U.S. ground troops from Turkey for a northern front in Iraq, the Pentagon is now asking to fly warplanes over Turkish airspace. The European Court of Human Rights has condemned Turkey for violating the human rights of jailed Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan. The BBC reports the court ruled that Öcalan did not receive a fair trial. He is currently serving a life sentence as the sole inmate on the prison island of Imrali. The world's first permanent war crimes tribunal was inaugurated yesterday with 89 member countries. The U.S. is not one of them. A federal appeals court ruled yesterday the 650 detainees held at a U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have no legal rights in the United States. Meanwhile, a federal district judge has ruled the U.S. citizen Jose Padilla must be allowed to meet with his attorney, even though he is considered to be an enemy combatant. And this news just in. The Serbian prime minister has been assassinated. Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, one of the leaders of the opposition that toppled Slobodan Milosevic, died on Wednesday after he was shot in an apparent assassination attempt. This according to Reuters, quoting a party source as saying he's dead, the source from Djindjic's Democratic Party. Again, independent B92 radio says Djindjic, who was 50 years old, was shot in the chest while entering the government building in Belgrade and that his condition is very serious. Sources from Djindjic's cabinet told the Associated Press that Djindjic sustained two shots in the stomach and back. But the latest news that we have, this is reporting MSNBC News Services, Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, one of the leaders of the opposition that toppled Slobodan Milosevic, died today after he was shot. Reports of a party source within his Democratic Party telling Reuters he is dead. The Air Force yesterday tested the largest conventional bomb in the American arsenal. The weapon known as Massive Ordnance Air Blast, or the mother of all bombs, may be dropped on Iraq. Virginia Congressmember Jim Moran apologized yesterday for his comments that Jewish support for war with Iraq was helping the administration move toward an attack, but Moran said he would not resign. On March 3rd, the Democratic congressmember said, quote, "If it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we would not be doing this. The leaders of the Jewish community are influential enough that they could change the direction of where this is going, and I think they should." Again, those the comments of Congressmember Jim Moran of Virginia. Last night, a convicted burglar who allegedly robbed and killed a fisherman was executed Tuesday by injection in Texas. He became the 299th prisoner since 1982 executed in Texas. Tonight, Delma Banks is scheduled to become the 300th person executed in Texas. Three former federal judges, including former FBI Director William Sessions, have urged the U.S. Supreme Court to block the execution. Banks' guilt has long been questioned. According to news reports, Banks was 3 hours away from the crime scene. Significant evidence against Banks came from two hardcore drug addicts, and the prosecution deliberately suppressed information about its arrangements with these witnesses. In California, a Humboldt County judge has ordered tree sitters to come down from their perches located on land owned by the Pacific Lumber Company. Environmentalists have been protesting Pacific Lumber's logging practices by sitting high in the branches of at least 18 trees in a 200,000-acre redwood forest. A judge yesterday dismissed conspiracy charges against the San Francisco police chief and the assistant chief, who said the evidence did not support a grand jury's indictment that they helped cover up a fight involving three off-duty police officers. And as hundreds of thousands of Iraqis' lives are in the balance, the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday banned the word French from its cafeteria menus because of the French opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Republican Bob Ney of Ohio unilaterally ordered the ban. He is chair of the House Administration Committee, and no vote was required. As debate on the issue raged, the Capitol Hill menu has already changed. A sign in the food court announced update, now serving in all House office buildings, Freedom Fries. French toast is also banned.
Here's what I want you all to do for me. Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the road below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the friend guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
cause don't they never had this?
Number one. Never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome of public enemy.
Don't believe the hype, public enemy. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country in this expanded edition of Democracy Now!. We've started an hour early. It's the second, the regular hour now that we're in.
And we have this news from Pakistan. Foreign journalists are accusing Pakistan's intelligence service of faking the arrest of alleged Al-Qaeda lieutenant Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Pakistani agents announced they arrested Mohammed several days ago in the city of Rawalpindi. The White House claims Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the mastermind behind the September 11th attacks, but journalists have begun to question whether the arrest was real. On Monday, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence held an unprecedented news conference to try to quell the questions. Officials played a grainy video they claim showed the arrest. But according to Reuters, few journalists were convinced. The video never showed Mohammed's face nor any sign of a struggle. Many said it looked like a crude reconstruction.
Some are accusing Pakistan of staging the raid to give it leeway to abstain in a UN vote on the Iraq war. The Pakistani government is under massive domestic pressure to oppose the invasion of Iraq. On Monday night, a senior ruling party official shocked British and American diplomats in Islamabad when he told Reuters the government had decided to abstain in that vote. Pakistan wasn't the only country to benefit from Mohammed's very publicized arrest. The Bush administration also had something to gain. On the Monday after the raid, the Wall Street Journal's top editorial headlined, "Al-Qaeda on the Run, Who Says the War on Terror Isn't Going Well?" That Thursday, President Bush opened a highly unusual press conference with an announcement about the arrest. The Reuters article appeared yesterday. Today, it looks as though not one major Western paper has picked up the story.
We're joined right now on the telephone from Islamabad by the Reuters Bureau Chief for Pakistan and Afghanistan, Simon Denyer. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you tell us what people are saying now in Pakistan?
Well, people aren't questioning that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was arrested. What they are questioning is when he was arrested and how the information was managed. What the former ISI chief, General Hamid Gul, told me yesterday was that he thinks that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was actually arrested some time before, possibly not even in the same city, not even in Rawalpindi, and that the arrest was publicized, was leaked, to give Pakistan leeway to abstain in any UN Security Council vote on Iraq. Now, we saw what was supposed to be a video of a raid on the house, as you say, which didn't convince many people that it was actually a genuine video. Hamid Gul also doubts that the raid which happened. There was a raid on March the 1st on a house in Rawalpindi, but he very much doubts that that raid was the same raid that captured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He says that they didn't properly surround the house, as they would have done if a senior al-Qaeda leader had been there. And he said that neighbors didn't report any sounds of gunfire. And we know from the Pakistanis that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed actually shot one of them in the foot when he resisted arrest. So from what they're saying, they suspect that the raid, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed may have been arrested previously and the information managed for political purposes.
Well, you were able to view the videotape at the Pakistani press conference. What about it suggested that it might have been a staged video?
Well, first of all, an ISI officer was seen briefing some of his men on the capture that was about to happen, telling them how they were going to go into the house. Bizarrely, the briefing was in English rather than in the Pakistani mother tongue Urdu. Officials later claimed that the briefing had been reconstructed for our benefit, but that the rest of the video was genuine. But obviously, that first reconstruction did raise a few eyebrows. Subsequently, the rest of the video showed a cameraman very casually filming people as they went about their business of breaking into the house, and then breaking into the door of the house and casually walking up the stairs. There was no urgency about any of the activity. It was all filmed very steadily by a cameraman who appeared to have a light and appeared to be very, very much at the forefront of the action. I think everybody that was there really doesn't imagine that the raid, when it happened, would have been such a calm and measured affair without any real sense of urgency. So I think that was another sign, perhaps, to a lot of the viewers that all was not as it seemed. And then finally, we saw Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or what the officials said were Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but the camera resolutely focusing on his back and his neck until a hood was produced and the hood put over his head. And a lot of journalists were sitting there saying, show his face, show his face. Well, of course, the video never showed his face.
Let's go to George Bush at his very rare press conference that he held last Thursday night. This is how he opened it.
Good evening. I'm pleased to take your questions tonight and to discuss with the American people the serious matters facing our country and the world. This has been an important week on two fronts on our war against terror. First, thanks to the hard work of American and Pakistani officials, we captured the mastermind of the September the 11th attacks against our nation. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed conceived and planned the hijackings and directed the actions of the hijackers. We believe his capture will further disrupt the terror network and their planning for additional attacks.
That was George Bush at his news conference on Thursday night. We are talking to Simon Denyer, who has done the piece Pakistan Accused of Staging Bin Laden Aid Arrest, about the arrest of Al-Qaeda kingpin Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and when it happened. Can you talk more about Lieutenant General Hamid Ghul and what exactly he said and what people in the area said about the arrest? And then I just want to let our listeners go. We're going to know that we're going directly to Belgrade, where Jeremy Scahill is standing by to talk about the latest news that Zoran Djindjic, has been assassinated. And we are going to talk about what has happened there with that breaking news coming in. Go ahead, Simon Denyer.
Yeah, well, General Ghul basically said that he thinks the news was leaked out to demonstrate Pakistan's anti-terror credentials at a very sensitive time for the country, when it's coming under a lot of scrutiny for perhaps not cooperating enough in the war on terror. So, indeed, when the ISI held their unprecedented news conference, they said that they held it to counter flack in the Western media that they weren't doing enough. And what Ghul said was that he suspected that this news had been deliberately leaked to give Pakistan some breathing space in the Western press, so that when they come to abstain in a UN Security Council vote, they will at least, public opinion in the West will be more likely to understand. I mean, Pakistan is in a very difficult position here, and the government finds itself under a lot of pressure from domestic religious right, I suppose you could call them, here in Pakistan, who've been organizing massive street protests against the war in Iraq. So the government continues to say that they would find it very difficult to vote to support a war in Iraq. And indeed, we were told on Monday night by a senior ruling party official that they have decided they would abstain in any Security Council vote.
And I just want to remind listeners, Pakistan is one of the six countries that the NSA document that was leaked, National Security Agency document was leaked, is one of the target countries of a massive U.S. spying campaign, where they are bugging the homes and offices of the U.N. Security Council diplomats. In their homes and at work to try to see how they are going to vote on Iraq. Simon Denyer joining us from Islamabad, the Reuters bureau chief for Pakistan and Afghanistan. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we go directly now to Belgrade, where the news has just come in that the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, one of the leaders of the opposition that toppled Milosevic, has been assassinated. Jeremy Scahill, welcome. Can you tell us what you know at this point?
Well, there has been no official confirmation yet that, in fact, Zoran Djindjic is dead, but there are unofficial reports coming out of the urgent care hospital where he was being treated that, in fact, the Serbian prime minister has been killed. The most recent information that we have is that he was shot three times, twice in the back, once in the stomach, though there are other reports that he did sustain a gun wound to his head. This is one of the most hated political figures in Serbia, despite the fact that as of now, as of this morning, he was the most senior representative of the Serbian government. This was the man who implemented the International Monetary Fund and World Bank program that now exists in Serbia, one of the people that was key in leading the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic, someone who had cooperated extensively with the United States and NATO, even at the time of the bombing of Yugoslavia. He was a man with many, many enemies. Politically, he had so many enemies in this country that it would be difficult to name them all. He was the force behind the extradition of Slobodan Milosevic, and more recently, the right-wing nationalist leader, Vojislav Šešelj. This is a man who's despised more than any other politician in Serbia, but also he was playing a very dangerous game with the Serbian mafia, with cigarette smuggling and involved with other dirty deeds. He is also someone who spoke frequently about his belief that he was a target and would ultimately be someone who would be targeted by assassins. Now, the most recent information that we have is that there were three gunmen involved with the attack. The reports are saying that he was that there were snipers in a building above the main Serbian government building in downtown Belgrade, and that the gunmen have escaped. Though there's a lot of conflicting information going on right now. Some people are saying that two of them are arrested. Others are saying that the police are still hunting for them. The entire center of the city has been closed off by the Serbian special police. They're searching vehicles moving throughout the city right now as we're speaking. But again, no definite confirmation that he has been killed, simply that he is in extremely critical condition. We're expecting any moment to get confirmation that Zoran Djindjic has been killed, but the official word has not come through yet.
And Jeremy, the fact that there were reports of gunmen on the roof of a government building would indicate at least that there might have been some involvement by government forces, no?
Absolutely, Juan. I mean, one of the things that's being said by some political analysts here who were involved with former security forces in this country is that it is very probable that the people that carried out this assumed assassination of Zoran Djindjic are either former members of the secret police or of a special police or army unit here in Serbia. Assassination is not a new event in Serbia. It just hasn't been one that has really pierced through the heart of this new so-called reformist government. But there are many disaffected security forces in the country, some of them disaffected by the politics of Zoran Djindjic and his government, leading toward a very pro-American administration, extraditing Serbian figures that are considered heroes still by large portions of this population. But also it has to be made clear that Zoran Djindjic did a lot of dancing with the devil, was very deeply involved with mafia politics.
I'm looking at the independent B92 radio report, Jeremy, and it says that two people have been arrested, one injured in the shooting. The building was sealed off by heavy state security, three ambulances parked in front. Djindjic appeared to have been targeted last month when a truck suddenly cut into the lane in which his motorcade was traveling to Belgrade's airport. The motorcade narrowly avoided a collision, and Djindjic later dismissed the February 21st incident as a futile effort that could not stop democratic reforms, he said. He said, if someone thinks the law and the reforms can be stopped by eliminating me, that's a big delusion. And then it goes on to talk about him, saying that he was blasted by Serbian nationalists, including his former ally, Kostunica, who stepped down as Yugoslav president earlier this month after the formation of a new state, Serbia and Montenegro, and that Djindjic's feud with Kostunica since the two jointly toppled Milosevic had virtually paralyzed the country's much-needed economic and social reforms, described by his opponents for seeking too much power and for mercilessly combating his political rivals, called the manager and little Slobo by his detractors for his authoritarian tendencies.
That's right. I mean, he basically what Zoran Djindjic did after he consolidated his power in Serbia was to take all of the security forces and intelligence agencies that Milosevic had at his disposal and essentially take them under his control. Right now on local television, we're watching some of the footage that was taken from a camera outside of the building shortly after Zoran Djindjic was shot. Very confused scenes right now, and very much conflicting reports on the local media here. Vojislav Koštunica, who you mentioned before, who up until a very short time ago was president of Yugoslavia, was just on national television denouncing this, saying that Zoran Djindjic was his colleague and that he's very saddened by the news. But I have to say that when this happened, I was in an area where many of the sort of rich nouveau of Belgrade hang out, and in a cafe where they were showing it, there was no one shedding any tears, and in fact, several people were actually making jokes about Zoran Djindjic. This was a man who was extraordinarily unpopular at various levels and someone who was known for his ruthless political tactics. This is someone who has a popularity rating absolutely in the cellar and yet managed to become the most powerful player in Serbian politics and some would say in organized crime because of his total co-optation of the Milosevic-era security forces in this country. This is also going to send the government into an absolute political tailspin because Gingrich was really running the country very much like a little dictator, and there's going to be a major political struggle in this country in which right-wing fascist parties could ultimately rise in their popularity. One of the most recent things Gingrich did was to extradite the man who got the second greatest number of votes in the recent Serbian presidential elections, Vojislav Šešelj. This party was gaining in popularity in recent months and recent weeks. Šešelj is now in The Hague. Gingrich has now been shot, and there's very major questions right now of the political future of Serbia. But it must be said that Zoran Gingrich was a man who was very, very close to the U.S. administration, closer than any other politician in Serbia.
But, Jeremy, if he was, though, so unpopular throughout the country, how was he able to maintain power?
Well, Juan, as I say, he basically made friends with the right forces in this country. When the October 5th revolt was organized, Zoran Gingrich was very careful to essentially bring into his fold all of the special police units, all of the intelligence forces, and say to them clearly, you all will have a political tomorrow if you just come over to my camp. And so he has solidified the main forces that kept Slobodan Milošević in power for the whole of the 1990s. And so Zoran Gingrich never won at the ballot. His party won at the ballot and then gave him the post of the prime minister. This is a man who could not beat any other political figure in Serbia, but he was a very shrewd political operator, and so that's why people call him Little Slobo or Little Slobodan Milošević, is because he was an extraordinary political maneuverer.
Jeremy, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill is back in Belgrade right now after spending over the last few months, many weeks, months in Iraq. Thank you, Jeremy, for that report. And the latest news we have from the BBC, the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Gingrich has been assassinated in the capital, Belgrade, shot in the front of the government offices around 1200 GMT. He was taken to hospital for emergency surgery, but a government minister told the BBC's Serbian section that he had died of his wounds. Unconfirmed Serbian media reports say that two people were arrested at the scene of the shooting. A police source told Reuters news agency he'd been hit twice by large caliber sniper rifle bullets. The editor of the Fonet news agency told BBC World Television Gingrich had been shot once in the stomach and once in the back. Immediately after the attack, police sealed off the city center location and halted traffic, searching cars and checking passengers. That latest news out of Belgrade. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to focus on the three pivotal African countries within the UN Security Council. We'll be speaking with Sally Booker and Jokey Jehu. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Angola, Guinea, Cameroon. Three African countries have been at the center of the world's attention this week. They all sit on the UN Security Council and are under enormous amount of pressure from both the United States and opponents of war in Iraq. Now, prominent African Americans, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Danny Glover, as well as a number of Washington, D.C.-based advocacy groups, are focusing on Africa, calling on the three nations to oppose a U.S. invasion of Iraq. A letter was recently sent to the three nations that warned a war in Iraq, quote, will have devastating economic and social consequences for the most impoverished and most vulnerable citizens and countries throughout the world.
According to a recent report by the Interpress Service, of the three nations, Angola is considered the most likely to go along with the U.S. Angola sells much of its oil to American companies and is in need of economic aid from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, where Washington holds great influence. Guinea, which receives military aid from Washington, is also considered more likely to vote with the Bush administration. Cameroon has been considered a staunch ally of French President Jacques Chirac.
We're joined now by Joki Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign, and Sally Booker, executive director of Africa Action. Sally, let's begin with you. Can you talk about each of these countries and what they are facing right now at the United Nations, aside from the bugs, the electronic eavesdropping equipment that the U.S. is now engaged in, bugging these countries as well as three others to find out what they are thinking before the vote?
Right. Well, all three of these countries are facing considerable pressure from the United States and Great Britain to support the U.S. effort to plunge the world into war in Iraq. Guinea, of course, actually occupies the presidency of the UN Security Council for the month of March, this critical month in terms of the Security Council's votes. You pointed out that Guinea does receive some military training from the United States, but in fact France is Guinea's largest donor and its second largest trading partner. The problem with U.S. checkbook diplomacy is that the U.S. actually is not a significant donor to Africa, contrary to perceptions. And so most of its incentives, in fact, are punitive incentives. Threats of withholding U.S. assistance or support at the World Bank and IMF for the meager debt relief programs on offer there. And so it's more of a threatening pressure coming from the United States and perhaps from France. They're receiving pressure in terms of greater positive incentives, increases in aid, trade, and investment. But I think it's key to point out that there would be great irony if the Angolan government were to vote with the United States. For decades, the U.S. employed illegal covert means to try and effect regime change in Angola, and the government of Eduardo dos Santos in Angola is the very same government that the U.S. for years sought to overthrow.
And in the case of Guinea, it also has a large Muslim population, doesn't it?
85% of the population is Muslim, and there's clearly, it's not just Guinea. Throughout Africa, there's overwhelming opposition to the war, certainly among the public, but even among the heads of state and government. When they met at the African Union a month ago, they unanimously adopted a resolution opposing this rush to war and calling for a solution through the UN system and allowing for inspections to take place and to be given greater time.
I'm looking, you raise the issue of Angola and what the U.S. has supported in the past and supporting Savimbi, Contra, basically, rebel in Angola. Isn't it true that Angola has the highest number of amputees as a result of landmines that have strewn through, are buried throughout the country?
It does. I mean, part of the covert war and the war of insurrection by UNITA involved the planting of enormous numbers of landmines. The government, of course, is guilty of that as well. And the country has the highest per capita number of amputees. The country is trying now to achieve a process of peace and reconciliation and reconstruction. And one of the punitive measures we hear already is that the State Department has put a freeze on aid programs that were designed to assist with the resettlement of people who've been displaced by the war in that country.
Joki Jehu, as you look at the kind of attention that we rarely see on African countries in this country, your comments on Guinea, Cameroon, and Angola.
Very clear message being sent not only to these three countries, but to other African countries. Play our game or you lose out. And one of the realities is that from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, these countries have been told, and in order to qualify for AGOA benefits, that they cannot vote, that they cannot engage. In fact, the quote is that they cannot engage in activities that undermine United States national security or foreign policy interests.
And just to say, AGOA is the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act.
Yes, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which the United States Congress passed in 2000. And basically what African governments, their hands were bound, years ago, and that that particular rope is being brought out right now and being told, you either you play our game or you lose out. And we see, not even just in the case of Africa, in the case of Turkey, that part of the package that Turkey was being offered is about IMF cash to help deal with the Argentina-like crisis. And I think that it is a very big incentive for countries to understand that the game that the United States is playing, not just with bilateral aid, but also multilateral aid through the IMF and the World Bank.
And is your sense that the appeals of Reverend Jesse Jackson and Danny Glover and other prominent African Americans will have any influence or impact on how these governments decide to vote?
Well, I hope that in addition to the position taken both by the African Union and the non-aligned movement, and people across Africa do not want this war. I'm from Kenya, and Kenya, remember, is a country that suffered a devastating bomb attack along with Tanzania in 1998. And again, we saw the attacks in Mombasa. And this is the fear that people across Africa have, that as the United States wages war, the so-called soft target end up being in our countries, and that it is the ordinary people who suffer. And in the case of the last bombing in November of 2002, you had young girls whose only piece of the global economy is to dance for tourists who come to Kenya and stay at these luxury hotels, and they died dancing when the bombs went off. And so people are looking at a situation where they are going to pay the price with their lives, and they have already paid the price with their lives. So it's not just the government, and it's not just the leaders from the United States. People across Africa are saying no to war. We got a report from a colleague in Senegal that last week in Dakar, Senegal, they had about 1,000 people marching in Dakar, but there were also peace demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations in other cities in Senegal. And that is true across the continent, where you hear of people organizing and getting together to talk about what is wrong with the war and the approach that the United States is taking in this particular situation.
Sally Booker, final comment.
Well, I think what's important to point out is that next to Iraq, if the United States goes to war, Africa will suffer the most after the people of Iraq themselves. Because of the downturn in the global economy, it's the most vulnerable in the world who are going to suffer the most, and those are people in Africa. This war is also diverting attention and resources away from the truly greatest global threat, and that is the threat of HIV/AIDS that's killing 3 million people a year, unlike Saddam Hussein. And finally, a preemptive war violates the foundations of the UN system and the international security framework upon which Africans have a vested interest as they themselves try to end conflicts that have been devastating the continent, and as they try to move forward in an environment of peace so they can address their real challenges, which are the eradication of poverty.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us. Sally Booker is Executive Director of Africa Action, and Joki Jehu heads up the 50 Years is Enough campaign. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we go to Jenin. Stay with us. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. There's a film in Israel called Janine Janine that cannot be seen there. On Sunday, the Israeli government asked the High Court to maintain its ban on the film. The film documents the Israeli invasion of the Janine refugee camp in April of last year. Israeli soldiers killed dozens of innocent civilians. Some Palestinians fought back, and several Israeli soldiers were also killed. On Sunday, the state argued the film purports to be a documentary, but instead portrays Israeli soldiers as brutal war criminals who are committing genocide. The Documentary Creators Forum and the film's director, Mohammed Bakri, are petitioning the court to lift the ban. They say it's a violation of freedom of speech and artistic expression and undermines the public's right to hear the film's message.
Director Mohammed Bakri has also been sued by five Israeli reserve soldiers who accuse him of libeling them as war criminals. During and immediately after the invasion, Israel cracked down on the flow of information. Journalists were not allowed into the camp, and Israeli propaganda officials immediately got to work. They succeeded in spinning news coverage of the invasion into a single question: did Israeli soldiers purposely massacre hundreds of civilians? News outlets haggled over the number of people killed instead of the known fact that Israeli soldiers had killed unknown numbers of innocent civilians.
Well, I recently had the opportunity to talk to journalist Ramzi Baroud. Baroud is the editor of a new book called Searching Janine: Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion 2002. He's also the editor of PalestineChronicle.com. Baroud coordinated a network of independent Palestinian journalists who were able to sneak into the camp, interview residents, and smuggle the interviews out. The interviews have been published in Baroud's new book. In a few minutes, Ramzi and Suzanne Baroud will read some of the accounts. But first, I asked Ramzi Baroud why he put the book together.
I was worried that the story of Janine might take many years for it to be narrated, and for the American public to never know the details of what, in fact, took place in Janine. So I decided that this time something different must take place. And I decided 2 weeks after the invasion to, in fact, go to Janine myself and to produce a book that would narrate, that would fill that gap that was left by having the victims, the people who lived through the invasion, and tell us the story on their own.
How did you get in?
I didn't get in. At the border between the West Bank and Jordan, the Israeli intelligence Shin Bet decided to talk to me, and I understood what that meant. Obviously they knew that I wasn't there to visit my family, as I said. Although I'm an American citizen, they said, "Ramzi, you are lying. We know what you are here for, and we are not going to let you in." Of course, I pleaded. I have a father. He is dying. Let me in. They wouldn't. Back and forth for over a month at the border, and they finally said, "If you are not going to leave, we are going to arrest you. We are going to keep you here." And that's when I decided to go back to Seattle. I assumed that would be the end of my search for the refugee camp, until I stopped by a Jordanian hospital, where a few wounded from Janine managed to make it to the hospital. I spoke with a few of them. One of them was a young man by the name of Mahmoud Amr. Mahmoud Amr is a 23-year-old Palestinian young man who was wounded twice by the Israeli army in the 2 weeks preceding the invasion. Mahmoud was between life and death. And again, I felt like I didn't have sufficient I didn't have what I needed in order for me to produce that book. There were only 2-3 people from Janine in that hospital. Until I asked Mahmoud Amr a question. I said, "What do you plan to do once you leave the hospital?" Now, Mahmoud Amr couldn't talk. He couldn't breathe on his own. He couldn't eat on his own. The doctor was just whispering to me, telling me that Mahmoud is going to die. I felt that my question was inappropriate. What are you planning to do? The man couldn't even talk. However, with a shaking hand, he asked his brother for a piece of paper. He gestured. His brother brought him a piece of paper. He wrote on the piece of paper that I will be going back to Jenin to fight for the camp. It was that particular experience that, in fact, compelled me, that I too intended to fight for Jenin, and from Jordan and back in Seattle, I assembled a team of 10 Palestinian reporters based in Jenin, in the refugee camp, in the town of Jenin, and under the Israeli army curfews. One of them was wounded during that. And under the Israeli army curfew, we managed to sneak into people's homes. We delivered the questions to them. We had their answers, and we sent our feedback and follow-up questions, and we did it as if I was, in fact, in Jenin, and we managed to produce the book that way.
You begin by talking about the reporters the photographers who made their way into Jenin.
Mahfouz Abu Turk is one of the most brilliant Palestinian photojournalists. He also works for Reuters, and he was perhaps the first journalist to enter Jenin after, in fact, in the last day of the invasion. He was arrested by the Israeli army eventually after he was cornered by one of their tanks, and he was taken to the Salem military point. He was there beaten. He was left there without food, without being allowed to go to the bathroom. Finally, when he was released, after Reuters exerted some pressure, Mahfouz lost his residency in Jerusalem. He's a Palestinian resident in Jerusalem, and he lost that residency for several months. Yet despite that, he kept coming back. He kept finding ways to leave Jerusalem, to go to the West Bank and to enter Jenin to help us with this project.
Your own history, born in a refugee camp in Gaza. How does that figure into your investigations? And can you talk a little about the Intifada then? You were born in the first Intifada and the Intifada now.
I was a teenager during the first Intifada in 1987. I lost several of my friends during the first Intifada. One of my best friends, his name was Ala. We were coming back from school one day, and we heard that the Israeli soldiers were attacking the girls' school. They used to do that to antagonize the boys and the other. You know, in the Middle East, girls are something very, or females are something tied to honor, and of course, Palestinians wouldn't allow for the settlers to go and harass and beat the girls. So, as kids, we ran and we held, you know, took rocks and we went to throw it at the soldiers and hoping that we could push them back. And my friend Ala was then shot in the head, and then he was brain dead. That particular experience, it really did change my life. I mean, I was living in a refugee camp all my life, and that by itself is a life-changing experience. But just seeing that happening in front of me not only filled me with anger, but I felt it was very important that the pain and the suffering of my people would at least be made where the whole world can learn about it. I know that we cannot change the world with a book. I know that, but at least we can let the world know of what is happening to the Palestinians. My family is still living in a refugee camp. Two of my cousins were killed in a battle with the Israeli army in the refugee camp of Buray, just 1 mile away from where I lived. Other relatives of mine were also killed during this Intifada. Now I am far away from Palestine, and I talk to my father, who's constantly holding the microphone up and telling me, here, the Apaches, they are bombing the camp. That incredible feelings, perhaps of guilt at certain points, compels me that I cannot rest. I cannot allow this to happen and move on with my life as if nothing is happening to my people. And I think that the cause of Palestine is a cause of humanity, that we are all responsible to let the world know of the injustices suffered by the Palestinian people in the refugee camps and elsewhere.
Ramsey, can you talk about how you're trying to get footage to us?
The same way that we managed to get all this information out of Jenin and all these pictures, the way we usually do it is we sneak the footage or whatever information we did for the book through a woman who would... females are usually easier to move through checkpoints. We will get the footage out of the Jenin refugee camp into the town of Jenin. From the town of Jenin, we'll try to find someone who is able to take it to Ramallah. Once we do that, we usually get help from internationals who are allowed to go to Jerusalem, since Palestinians are blocked and they are not allowed to Jerusalem unless they have a very special permit. And from there, we are going to send the footage from Ramallah to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, we are going to put the footage in a box that doesn't look suspicious, that is with other things that might pass, at the Israeli post office in Jerusalem. Process like this usually take a long time. However, since we have done it through this book and we are really good at it right now, that I think it's possible.
We're not hearing a lot of news about the occupied territories right now with all of the attention on Iraq. How do you see the U.S. efforts to invade Iraq now connected to, or do you see them connected to, your experiences in Palestine?
I recently wrote an article talking about how the potential war in Iraq is in fact a double disaster for Palestinians. Double disaster, the first disaster, of course, is that Iraq is a nation that's very dear to Palestinians, as it's very dear to the whole world, of course. But the other disaster is the fact that there are many indications that Israel intends on carrying out a massive deportation, expulsion of Palestinians in the West Bank. This issue is no longer a taboo in Israel. They talk about it openly. In fact, over 60% of the Israeli public now, according to a poll carried by the Tel Aviv University, support the voluntary expulsion of Palestinians. Palestinians are aware of the fact that Sharon is planning such a move because of his constant talk about Israel's demographic needs. My worry is that this process has in fact began in the areas in the northern West Bank, villages close to the Israeli border, near the so-called security fence. Several villages have in fact been demolished. We are talking about Nazlat Isa. The people of Ya'anun have been completely sent out of their land, and much of the land in that area has their owners have been receiving notifications from the Israeli army saying that your land is now military zones and it's going to be you would have to leave before the bulldozers arrive. So my fear is that process have in fact already begun, and a war on Iraq could lead to another disaster, another Nakba, in fact, for the Palestinians of being sent out of the West Bank.
Your book, Searching Jenin, begins with a map of Jenin. And then it's divided into the testimonies of the residents of Jenin and then the international observers who came in afterwards. Just go back and forth, if you would, Ramzi Baroud and Suzanne Baroud, and read some of the testimony.
The following is a testimony of Jamal, a 68-year-old woman, and her account of her attempt to rescue her 35-year-old son from her home that was being demolished. Jamal was 35 years old. He was retarded and paralyzed and couldn't care for himself at all. The shelling was continuing on the second floor of the house, and we were caught on on fire after the shell landed inside. At this time, I was with my son and daughter. I fed my son and gave him a drink of water. I changed his diaper. The next day, I took a white scarf and we went outside. I could not carry Jamel alone, so I left to find help. Every time a tank saw us, I would wave the white scarf so he wouldn't hurt us. I went up the stairs, and one of the soldiers saw me. "I beg you," I said, "my son is over there by himself. He is paralyzed. He can't eat or drink on his own." Three older women from the neighborhood came to help me convince the soldiers to let me bring my son. "The commander is taking a nap," said the soldier. "Taking a nap or not," I said, "I need my son." Oh, how much I cried that day. But finally a soldier said, "Okay, go get him." "I'm an old woman. I cannot do it on my own," I said. "I need someone strong to come and help me." At that time, a bulldozer was demolishing the neighbors' homes. We arrived to the house and we found that the cupboard had fallen. Part of the wall had fallen on my son. He was alive, but he was screaming in pain. My son had never spoken a word in his life. My daughter looked at him and said, "Brother, we will try and move the debris." For the first time in his life, he spoke. He cried out, "O Allah." The bulldozer started pushing the house down while he was still inside. "Stop, stop," we screamed, but the driver wouldn't listen. We finally had to run out, leaving Jamel under the rubble. I was screaming, my son is inside." The Israeli soldiers shouted back at us women, and they called us whores. Jamel will never disappear from my mind. For 3 days, he remained under the rubble. He was buried with the house.
And that is all that we have time for today. Suzanne Baroud and Ramzi Baroud, their book, Searching Jenin, Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion 2002. Estimates range of Palestinians who died in Jenin between 52 and hundreds. At least 22 Israeli soldiers died. And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Tonight, Charlie Rose, I have a discussion with him about the media and the war with Iraq. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's a video or audio copy of today's program, 1-800-881-2359. If you want more information on how you can get Democracy Now! On your radio or television station, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!